Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decalage podcast. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. Today's guest is David Allen Sibley. David is the author and illustrator of many books, most notably The Sibley Guide to Birds, and most recently, the book What It's Like to Be a Bird. Today's conversation with David was really, really interesting. It was great to get to hear him talk about his love of birding and his process in doing his paintings. I really, really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you will as well. So, as always, thanks for reading, thanks for listening, and enjoy today's conversation with David Allen Sibley. David Allen Sibley, welcome to the Decalage podcast.
Thanks.
So, David, you're pretty well known in certain circles, anyway, but in others maybe less so. So maybe we can begin at the beginning. Tell me, where'd you grow up? Where'd you come from? How'd you get to be who you are?
I grew up. We moved a few times when I was a kid, so I grew up some in California, and then finished high school in Connecticut, or through fourth grade through high school in Connecticut. So I usually tell people I'm from Connecticut, but I have some California roots also. And my father's an ornithologist, so I grew up with birds being a part of life. There were bird books in the house. His friends were, colleagues were bird fanatics. So when we went for got together with other people on the weekend and went for a hike, it was kind of bird focused, and that's I really enjoyed that. I like to draw from a very young age, just because neither one of my parents does anything artistic, but all me and my siblings all really enjoyed drawing. Sort of craft stuff. My mother would throw a bunch of crayons and paper and scissors on the floor, and we'd lay there and do stuff. And drawing was fun, and birds were my favorite subject to draw. And I just got a lot of personal satisfaction out of that from a very young age, and a lot of positive feedback from my father and his friends, a lot of encouragement. So I just kept at it.
So I guess the first thing I'm thinking about is I have an 11-year-old son, and we like to hike together, but there is little hope of seeing any wildlife when he's with me. You know, he's loud, and he's throwing rocks, and he's picking things up, and just all over the place. And so I have to wonder what that experience was like for your father, a professional ornithologist, taking you as a child on a hike. Were you that way? Were you naturally inclined to be quiet? How did that work?
Not particularly. I wouldn't say I was, I wouldn't say I was unusually attentive for an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old. I heard a quote somewhere along the way. I don't know where I heard it, who to attribute it to, but it was something like, in order for kids to appreciate nature, they have to mess it up a little bit. And that was me throwing rocks, turning over logs, breaking sticks, building dams on little streamlets, and learning about nature through that. And when I think back on going on these hikes with my father, he didn't hand us binoculars and field guides and say, come on, we're going to look at birds. He just said, we're going for a walk. And there were other people along. And when they found something interesting, they would point it out. And often it would be a snake or a mole cricket or a plant or something like that. Sometimes it was birds, but it wasn't, It wasn't a sort of an academic exercise. It was just, let's go outdoors and have some fun and see what we find. And that for us was really fun. We then, of course, after you see a mole cricket, you start turning over logs and trying to find your own, trying to find more. And then you find, you know, a scorpion or something really exciting. And so it just kind of built from that. But it was always just the, I think the primary thing was just getting outdoors and experiencing it. And the interest follows from that.
Yeah. So maybe there's hope for my son after all.
Yeah. You know, I like to think I was a pretty normal 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 10 and older, I was already really, really interested in birds and knew a lot about them. Okay. And that also, for a kid, is very empowering to be able to go out with a group of adults. And a lot of them would know less about birds than I did, even at 10, 11 years old, that I was the one who was spotting birds and identifying them and pointing things out to the adults. It's very encouraging, empowering for a kid. But kids are so good at that. That just a sponge for soaking up information and sharp eyes and sharp ears. So it's kind of a natural for the kids who really get into birding the way I did. You become an expert at a very young age.
Yeah, that's cool. And so to go back to your art. So as a kid, you enjoy drawing, you enjoy painting. Were you drawing birds in the beginning, or just kind of anything and everything?
Yeah, it was kind of anything and everything. But birds and dinosaurs were my two favorite subjects when I was really young. And a lot of what I did then, you know, when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, I would pull a book off the shelf, some big picture book with large, really exciting, dramatic pictures of birds and trace those pictures. And I think I learned a lot by tracing, just sort of the hand movements, the muscle memory of following the lines of the outline of the bird and putting the eye in the right place and all those kinds of lessons. I think I learned a lot by tracing. And it was very early on when I really was focusing on birds.
So David, I want to jump all the way ahead just for a minute. You mentioned pictures or books with large dramatic pictures in them. Your latest book, which I have here, What It's Like to Be a Bird. Out of all of your books, it's got large dramatic pictures in it. Was that on your mind when you did this book, or is that just coincidence?
Yeah, that was very much on my mind. The seed for this book started as an idea for a children's book. So that was the initial work on it, the initial sort of design, just kind of brainstorming ideas for what it would be like, was all with the children's book in mind. And it turned into something somewhat different, or very different from what I initially envisioned. But some of the things that carried through were these big dramatic illustrations. And I was very much, you know, trying to channel my own 10-year-old self and imagine to do the paintings that I would have enjoyed when I was a bird obsessed 10-year-old.
That's great. That's great. I love knowing that. Yeah. And then, you know, teenage years, high school, college, what was that like for you?
Yeah, I was very, I was pretty obsessed with birds. I was really focused on that to the exclusion of kind of social life at high school. all the, I would come home from school and just go, into my room to read bird books, study birds, or go out on my bike and explore and look for birds. And on the weekends, it was me and my father and my brother going out with other birders in the community in Connecticut, and driving all over the state looking for birds. So that was, it was a, a big part of my life. The same way, kids who are, into chess or hockey or any sport, their whole life revolves around that. And there weren't really organized events for birding, but there's a local community and a club and some field trips. And that's what we did. And it was great. It's a really great, the birding community is in general very welcoming and sort of forward-looking. I think birding is a very forward-looking hobby because it's all about what's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure.
And what you might find the next time you go out in the field.
Yeah, so it's a little like fishing in that way.
Yeah, yeah. And the one big difference from fishing is that everyone can enjoy the same bird.
Yeah, that's right.
If a rare bird is found, everyone can see it and enjoy it. Unlike the really good fishing hole that each person has their own favorite.
I'm not going to share mine with you. You're right. It is different.
Yeah. So it's a very generous and welcoming and optimistic sort of community.
And so if I understand it right, you at least started college with the idea of being an ornithologist as well. Is that right?
Yeah. I started college reluctantly. I tried to talk my parents into letting me take a year off to go birding, and they steered me towards college. I think knowing or suspecting that a year would have turned into two and then five, which is, I think, realistic expectation at the time. And I imagine they weren't too surprised when I told them after a year that I had filled out the paperwork to take a leave of absence and was going to go work at Cape May, New Jersey, counting hawks for the fall. And that
they were supportive of that.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah. They were disappointed. They really didn't want me to leave college entirely. I kind of kept my connections. I had started at Cornell and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is there. So while I was a student during that year, I had gotten a part-time job working in their Library of Natural Sounds. Cataloging recordings there. And when I took my leave of absence as a student, I worked for a few months at Cape May, New Jersey, counting hawks. And then I went back to Ithaca and continued my part-time job at the lab working in the Library of Natural Sound. So I think that helped my parents to accept me not being a student, that I was working and I still had at least some tenuous connection to the university. And I really, I dropped out of classes, but I was kind of pursuing my own real world independent study degree in bird identification and drawing. And I knew what I wanted to do, and I knew what I needed to do to get there. I was very driven.
So let me stop you. You knew what you wanted to do and you knew what you needed to do to get there. What was that thing? What was it in your mind that you were going to go do?
I think I had the idea of a field guide, a guide to all the birds of North America. I think that was my primary goal from even when I was in high school. And I was kind of, you know, I wasn't really ready to commit to it. But I told someone a couple of years after The Bird Guide came out, I told them that I, you know, it hadn't really been a priority for me until pretty recent, you know, until I started working on it in the late 1980s. And there was someone who had known me in college in 1979, and they said, "Oh, you talked about it all the time in 1979. So I think that was my priority. I wanted to produce a field guide and do all the illustrating and writing myself. And the way to get there was just to get to know all of the birds of North America and all of their variations, to draw them all, to learn everything about how to identify them all.
David, that's a hell of a project. And I mean, it's a hell of a book, right? This one's a little beaten up and in a lot of backpacks, but you know, it's one thing to say, "Hey, I'm going to write an illustrative field guide," but what was that process like? I mean, there's thousands of illustrations in here, and you know, we're 540 pages, and how did this book come about, really?
Yeah, it was really just, you know, I had the idea, I had the goal, and the way, and the then it was necessary then to go find all the birds, see them all, learn everything, and I was doing sketches, taking notes, kind of compiling all this information. I didn't have a real, I wasn't plugging things into a template, building a database, an actual database, but kind of in my mind, I was building that and thinking, I don't know this species in the winter. I haven't seen them in the winter. I don't know what their behavior is, what their sounds are. So I would plan my travel to go spend some time in an area where I would see those species in the winter or during migration or whatever. So I was kind of filling in gaps in my knowledge of all the birds of North America at all seasons. And that was from 1980 when I left college until 1992 when I kind of settled back at Cape May, New Jersey, and then not long after that got a contract and started working full time on the actual painting and writing for the book. But during that 12 years from 1980 to 92, I was most of the time kind of crisscrossing the continent in a camper van or other different kinds of travel or temporary residence. And just crisscrossing the country looking at birds and trying to plan it so that I would keep filling in gaps or kind of even out my knowledge of the whole country and all the birds.
Did you ever feel like, "Oh man, I think I missed one"?
Not in that way. It was always, yeah. It was always, you know, birding. I just love birding. That was my initial love, was just the experience of birding, just getting out there and finding the birds and getting to know them. So it was always a much more positive sort of a feeling of, "Oh, I need to see this species," or there's a whole bunch of birds in this whole region that I haven't been there in the winter, so I don't have any idea what they do, what they sound like. I want to go there and spend a couple of months and get to know that area.
So is it possible that the goal subconsciously was never to write the bird guide? The bird guide was just the justification for the travel and seeing all the birds?
I guess in a way it was. But I think the the reason that the travel was interesting is because it was leading up to this bigger product, this big project. So the guide was really the motivation, kind of the reason for doing everything else. And everything else was really fun. And but if I wasn't really committed to doing the guide, I would still be out there traveling, just right. learning more, because there's so much more to learn even now. And that I think that keeps a lot of people from completing projects, that if you enjoy the research and the process so much that you never say, oh, I need to work on this part a little bit more. And the years go by and the project never gets finished. And I luckily have that the mentality of, I want the project to be finished. And if it's, even when there are little gaps or things I would like to research more, I'll just put it all together and put it out there.
Now, it still seems like a heroic project, but if I'm correct, you were kind of a working artist from early days. Like your first paid work was high school.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I didn't make very much money.
Sure.
Doing drawings, but I did get hired to do some drawings for a travel brochure, for some travel brochures for a company that was doing international wildlife trips in the 1970s. So I did pen and ink drawings. And back in those days, that was all the inexpensive reproductions that newsletters and sort of local magazines were looking for. It was all black and white. That was the reproduction that they were capable of doing. Color was too expensive, and it's hard to remember those days. But that's why one reason that I really did a lot of pen and ink drawing, because it's strictly black and white and easy to reproduce. But I really enjoyed doing pen and ink drawing, and I think it's a great medium for learning. It forces you to think of the thing in black and white. So you have to reduce the image that you're producing, or the thing that you're trying to represent on paper, you have to reduce it to black and white. And I think that's a great exercise. And I really think I learned a lot by having to do all that pen and ink drawing. But yeah, I was finding work. I did those travel brochure drawings, and I was doing drawings for other things here and there. And then more and more, I started getting requests for black and white drawings. And then that led to, once I ended up at Cape May in the early 1980s, Pete Dunn and Clay Sutton were there and already working on the book that became Hawks in Flight, and asked me to do the illustrations for that.
Yeah. I have that one stacked up in front of me as well.
Which and those are all pen and ink drawings, all black and white. But that led to then years of studying hawks and working on drawings of hawks, and that were eventually the final drafts were finally published in Hawks in Flight. I think that was 1988 when that came out.
It's interesting because your pen and ink drawings are beautiful, and in a sense, very, very different from your painting. To me, in some ways, there's perhaps more detail, more scientific, but not necessarily less artistic. I don't know. So if you would, David, talk about kind of your process today of your paintings. How do you go about that? Are you working from photographs? Are you working from memories? A bit of both? How do you think about that?
It's different now from what it was back when I was working on the field guide. I think relying a lot more on memory and my own field sketches. Everything was fresh in my mind. And there weren't a tremendous number of photographs to look at for reference. But even then, photographs were my primary reference material for making sure that I got the color patterns just right, you know, exactly how far the yellow extends down the belly, all those kinds of details. Photographs have always been my primary reference material. But photographs really, they require interpretation. It's like looking at, I would say any drawing, any artistic representation of a bird is an interpretation of it. As the artist, you're looking at the thing and you're converting it into an image in two dimensions. And so it requires simplifying, deciding which details are important and how to transfer those onto the paper, and then using your techniques, your own style, your own technique, and putting a little kind of individual stamp on it. And when you're doing that from a living bird in the wild, as I do with the pencil sketches in the field, that is by far the best way to do that, because you have all the information there in front of you. You have the bird itself. And there's all kinds of subtle, indescribable, intangible things that find their way into those drawings that can never be duplicated by copying a photograph. So when I'm back in the studio and using photographs as reference material, I'm still relying a lot on my sketches, and also just the time in the field of sketching, of learning those intangible things about the birds that I can then, when I look at a photograph and I take some information from that and transfer it onto the paper, but I'm still filtering it through my own experience. And then I look at the partly finished drawing or painting through the lens of my own memory, of my own kind of mental image of what the bird is really like. And I make all kinds of adjustments to that. So that's kind of a long and involved way of saying that I use photographs, but I filter everything through my own memory, personal experience, based on all those years of sketching.
Yeah. And I guess in that way, you're not painting a specific bird, you're kind of painting the essence of that bird, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's totally what I'm going for in the field guide. I'm trying to capture the average, typical, the generic sense of that species, so that it will be the most useful for identification in the field.
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. Do you paint every day?
No, I don't. And sometimes, and even back in the 80s when I was traveling and sketching full time, sometimes a few months would go by and I wouldn't do any drawings. I would just be birding. And usually that was when I was traveling with friends and kind of distracted, and the focus was more on moving quickly and finding lots of species and visiting a lot of different places. So there wasn't really time for sketching. But I always found that when I picked up a pencil again after a couple of months off, I felt like my drawings were better, even though I hadn't done any drawings in that intervening time. I had spent so much time just immersed in birds during that stretch and watching and really getting to know the birds, that my drawings would be better. Like I had a better sense of what the birds looked like. So the next time I picked up a pencil, I could use some of that to draw the birds.
To go back to the latest book for a minute, What It's Like to Be a Bird. How did you choose which birds to include in this book?
Yeah, it's always a challenge. But this book, like I said, it started out as an idea for a children's book. So I wanted it to be an introduction to all of the most familiar species. And the initial idea was that it would be a field guide, just identification, how to distinguish the species. But it would obviously have to include crows and jays and nuthatches and house sparrow, starling, all those, the birds that people would see in their everyday life, in their backyards. And as the book developed and turned into more of a kind of an exploration of all of the most fascinating things that I stumbled upon about birds and trying to answer a lot of common questions about birds, then it opened the door to including other species like roadrunner. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, roadrunner is a backyard bird. If you live in Arizona and parts of Texas, it's a backyard bird.
It is
bird.
For me, actually. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
But things like puffin, bald eagle, again, they're backyard birds for some people. Puffin for very few people. It turned into more of a collection of species that were familiar just in a general sense that people would have heard of. Everybody loves puffins. Everybody loves, everybody's heard of a peregrine falcon, roadrunner. I'm trying to think of some of the other less widespread, less familiar species that are in the book. But that was the general idea of, and I wanted to try to represent the whole range of bird life in North America. So I've got a couple of sandpipers, a couple of ducks, and a range of songbirds.
And it seems like for listeners, the way the book is laid out, there's kind of a big, on the left hand page, kind of a big portrait, and then right hand side tends to be more detailed. But it seems like in those portraits, seems like you had quite a bit of fun. I mean, the one I'm thinking about in particular is the page on gulls, and they're eating goldfish crackers.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to illustrate the birds in dramatic, kind of dramatic action scenes, the things that would appeal to me as a kid. And I also wanted the book to be really, I guess, relatable is the the buzzword. That I wanted it to depict things that would make people feel like, oh, I've seen that, I know that place, and that meant in a lot of cases including human things in the images, which is kind of unusual in nature art to include signs of humans in the image. But that the gulls at the beach that have found an unguarded blanket and snack box, and they've tipped out the box of goldfish crackers and are gobbling them up while the kids run back yelling, waving their arms. So that's I really wanted to, when I could, include scenes like that. And so there's the killdeer sitting on its nest on the ground, and in the background are some houses and a person walking a dog, which then there's one of the essays there is about how do ground nesting birds survive without being found by predators like dogs. But it was a conscious choice to try to make the images scenes that would be really familiar to people and show how the birds are intertwined with our lives.
Yeah, one that I really enjoyed that was both familiar and a little out of the ordinary was the red-tailed hawk one. You know, you see them on the power lines or the power poles all the time, but in this painting, it's from the hawk's vantage point. So you see the roadway down below, and it's just very interesting.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad you liked that one. Some of the paintings like that, I painted the hawk. I did the painting of the portrait of the hawk sitting there. And then for weeks, months, actually, I stared at that painting. I mean, I had it hanging on the wall and was working on other things, but I would see it all the time and think, what am I going to do with the rest of that painting? What am I going to put around that red-tailed hawk? And eventually settled on just a simple suggestion of a divided highway, roadway, kind of disappearing into the distance. And but there are quite a few of the paintings in the book had that kind of long thought process of there's the bird. Now what else is going to be in there?
How big are these paintings when you work on them?
These are about 15 by 20 inches. They're just about double the size of the reproductions in the book.
Okay.
And for those big portraits on the left-hand page in this book, I wanted those portraits to be life-size. The birds on those pages are roughly life-size.
Okay.
That created some challenges, but one of the challenges was just knowing how big to paint them. And the simplest way to do that was just to double them. So I have measurements of all the species. So I would work on a sketch of how I wanted the bird to be posed and then figure out how much I needed to enlarge that sketch to make it double life size on that sheet of paper. And once I had it roughly double life size, I'd do the painting so that when it's reduced to the size of the book, it would appear at life size.
Yeah. Now, is that the size you typically work in, or do you work in other sizes depending on the application?
That all the paintings in the bird guide, I did a sheet of paper that essentially holds all the images that appear on one page in the book, and the sheet of paper is then again it's about 14 by 22, I think. So that's about three times the size of the reproductions in that book. But in that case, I wasn't too concerned about the exact size of the images. I just wanted to get them all on the page. In general, I enjoy painting large images. So I'm more comfortable working on a big sheet of paper with a larger image. I can use a larger brush. I can be a lot more loose and relaxed about the brush strokes. So I'm not hunched over with a tiny 000 brush trying to put little tiny markings on it. I'm using larger brushes. I'm working quickly and loosely and working at that size. If I go over the lines by a millimeter or two here and there, it doesn't really matter. It's not that critical. And then when it's reduced to the size that it appears in the book, it looks like a very detailed and carefully painted image. But the originals are not that carefully done.
But when we go back to your guide, were those relatively small paintings? I mean, they mainly appear as thumbnails, more or less, in that book. How did that process work?
Yeah, the originals, each bird is maybe 5 or 6 inches long. So for the small songbirds, it's life size, or in some cases, even larger than life. the original paintings for birds like great blue heron, it's much, much smaller than life size. But those originals are fairly large. They get very small when they're reproduced in the book. Yeah, that process was quite different from the big portraits that I did for What It's Like to Be a Bird. For the field guide, I would lay out the whole page, so 8 or 12 images, all outlined in pencil on the sheet of paper for one or two species, and then I would start painting all of them. I'd mix the gray for the shading. That's the first layer I usually put on, is the shadows, and get some of that gray wash on my brush and color all the pencil outlines in turn with that shading, and then mix the next color and start putting that on and work my way through sort of assembly line, developing 8 or 12 individual birds, building up the layers on all of them at the same time.
Okay. I am curious about one of your other guides, the Sibley Guide to Trees.
Yeah.
How did that book come about?
That's the story of that, is that once the bird guide was finished, I did a couple of other sort of the spin-off bird books, the Eastern and Western Field Guide, the Bird Life and Behavior, and Birding Basics. All those books came out within a few years. And I wanted, once that was all done, I wanted another big project. I really enjoyed the whole process of putting the bird guide together. And I just couldn't get excited about sort of digging in deeper to some aspect of birds, and trying to do, you know, a more in-depth guide to sparrows, say, something like that. I thought about ideas like that, but it just wasn't that exciting. I wanted something new and different and really comprehensive. So I thought about doing a guide to some other group, some other part of nature. And initially I settled on butterflies, and I started working on a guide to butterflies, but for many reasons, not least of which was that I live in Massachusetts and we only see butterflies for about 4 months of the year. And so then the idea of a guide to trees came to me, and it's, you know, it immediately struck me that trees and birds have a lot in common in terms of just everyone's, your everyday experience with them. They're the two things that we see every day. If you look out your window right now, you'll see trees and birds. They change with the seasons. You can identify them from a distance. You can identify them by shape or color or details. There are about 700 species of trees in North America, in the United States, and the same with birds. So it all really just matched up, and I thought, this is what I'm going to do. And I thought at the time, I also thought that I've always been interested in all aspects of nature, even though I focused on birds. So I've owned a lot of field guides to trees and used them. And I was always frustrated that I wanted a field guide to trees that was set up more like the bird guides. Bird guides are really illustration based. You're just matching images. You see something and you flip through the book until you find a picture that matches. That's how a bird guide works. And the tree guides are mostly based more on botanical keys, which is partly by necessity that some trees are very difficult to identify. And but anyway, I thought there was an opportunity to create a guide that was really different. So I took on trees, and it turned out to be a lot more of a challenge than I had expected, and took 7 years instead of four. Yeah. But I'm really, really pleased with the result, and really pleased that I took it on and did it. It was a fascinating project, and I was really pleased with the result.
It's a great book, David. I do want to ask you. So I have a very close friend who is a big birder, lives in Houston, in the field most weekends, certainly migration season in the field. And you know, Texas Gulf Coast, the winter birds will come stay here. We get birds in the spring migrating through. It is his belief that we are not getting the numbers and diversity of birds coming through now that we were some years before. Is that consistent with what you're seeing as well? And if so, do you have any ideas why that might be?
Yeah, that is consistent with what I see and hear. You know, my own experience, I've spent chunks of time in different places. So in the 1970s, growing up, I was in Connecticut, on the coast of Connecticut. And then I traveled around, but spent a lot of time at Cape May, New Jersey, off and on in the 1980s, and then through the 1990s. And since 2000, I've lived here in Massachusetts. I suppose if I went back to Connecticut now, or back to Cape May, and spent a year in one of those places, I would have a better basis for comparison. But species here in Massachusetts are less numerous than I would expect based on my childhood in Connecticut. But now I don't know if that's a fair comparison. I know that at Cape May, the birding is so weather dependent, and I know it is also on the Texas coast, that the big fallouts of birds happen in when you get just the right weather conditions. So if the weather patterns aren't quite right, it can be a really disappointing migration season. We know that weather patterns have changed a lot in the last few decades, and that definitely has an impact on the birds. So it becomes really hard to separate weather and other effects from the real changes in bird populations to know which is the bigger factor. But at the same time, there are a lot of species are really well documented declines. Measurements where there's steady effort over a period of many decades, and they find fewer individuals of many species there. I would say that it's actually balanced partly by a lot of species are increasing. So it's not just a simple birds are disappearing message. It's a bird populations are changing. It's also, you know, each species kind of has its own story. Each species has its own migration route, migration timing, its own food habits, habitat preferences, different wintering areas, different breeding areas. They're all affected differently by all of the myriad changes that are going on around us. So it becomes, again, really difficult to tease apart all of that and to make any generalizations. If you care about it and you want to help birds and stop the declines, it's really difficult to focus on any one or three things that will help. You know, climate change is one of the biggest threats to everything right now. So any action we can take to reduce the advance of climate change is good, but we're going to see changes coming for decades, no matter what we do. So that's kind of a given. For what people can do in their own backyards, there's cats outdoors are a big problem, and I know it's a very contentious issue, and I know it's been a contentious issue in Texas particularly. But it's well documented. Cats kill birds, and cats that live outdoors kill a lot of birds. It's not trivial. It's hundreds of millions of birds a year, and for species that have populations in the millions or tens of millions, which is a lot of species, they're only producing a certain number of young each year, and a large percentage of those perish during migration and winter. Right. The first year anyway, and having cats take a significant percentage out of that it's easy to imagine that cats could be the tipping point impact on a lot of these species. Window strikes kill a lot of birds, and that's another one that it's so widespread and low level. You know, on everyone's house, you probably have a couple of windows that birds hit, and a few birds a year might hit your windows and die, which doesn't seem significant until you multiply it by the number of houses across the U.S.
Right.
So there are things you can do to reduce or prevent window strikes. The American Bird Conservancy has really done a good job on both of those issues, cats and window strikes, and if you go to their website, you'll find ratings of the different methods of window protection and things you can buy, things you can order to quickly and easily protect your windows.
Okay.
And the last thing I'll mention is backyard habitat and just making your yard, making your neighborhood more friendly for birds. And part of that is using chemicals, insecticides, pesticides. Have an impact on birds. So buying organic produce, promoting local organic farms, and letting your yard be more organic will be much, much better for the birds.
Yeah, those are great tips. David, tell me about the last book you read.
The last book I read was a book called Washington Black.
Okay.
And it was I think it's a few years old, but it made a big splash. It's about a young boy who grows up, he's born a slave in the Caribbean, and just by chance is taken under the wing of not the owner of the plantation, but the owner's brother. And then it's discovered that he has an incredible talent for drawing and nature observation and drawing. And that kind of carries him through. It opens doors for him. And so it's his story it's a fictional story of his life, but drawing nature is a thread, a really important part of the plot.
That sounds great.
It's kind of a fun book. And
yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, really interesting.
That sounds great. I'll have to check it out. David, where can people find out more about you and your work? Where's the best place to follow that?
I have a website, sibleyguides.com. There's a lot of information there about my books and apps and artwork and lots of other stuff. So.
All right. Well, we'll make sure and link to that in the show notes. David, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate the time and love your books. So thank you for that.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Just a few quick things before you go. First, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Spotify. Commenting on or rating the show would be great too. You can also go to the website, thedecaledge.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode or a blog post. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website or via Instagram at @the_decal_edge. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro and ending music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, The Darmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless. Thank you.